everybody, and welcome to Eagle Eye View. I'm Jacob Noderman. October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month, which, if you have been asked to change your password recently or taken part in any online security training, that might explain why. To help walk us through the kinds of things we can do to keep ourselves safe at home, as well as give us a big picture on what cybersecurity is being used for on a global security scale, we have a guest with incredible credentials. He is the assistant professor within the Department of Information Technology, currently serving as the director of the Center of Applied Cyber Education and a primary contact for various cybersecurity exercises, including with the Army Cybersecurity Institute at West Point. He has coordinated all aspects of cybersecurity outreach for the university and the community, and just recently, he was given the Faculty Award of Service within the Alan Paulson College of Engineering and Computing. Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Katz.
Well, thank you very much.
For this Cybersecurity Awareness Month, we're going to go micro and macro. We're going to talk about how it's playing a role in global logistics as well as modern warfare, and also give you some tips on how you can protect yourself and your family at home, which could be the difference between having a secure identity and losing everything. But before we get into all that heavy stuff, I want to play a little game with you. Is that okay?
Okay.
We're going to give you a scale of 0 to 10. I want you to tell me how dangerous this item is on a scale of 0 to 10. Can you do that for me?
Okay.
All right, sweet. We'll start with this. Public Wi-Fi, scale of 0 to 10, how dangerous is it?
Can I go to 11? 10. I would say 10. Public Wi-Fi is dangerous because people just don't protect themselves against it. They won't put a VPN on their phone. They won't put antivirus on their phone. And so, yeah, I would say public Wi-Fi is a 10.
Saving my password to my internet browser.
I would say in terms of danger, with 1 being not dangerous and 10 being dangerous, it's probably above 5. It's somewhere 5, 6. They're getting, depending on the browser you use, they're getting better at it. They really are.
A computer built-in webcam. Lord knows there have been reports about people's computers with a built-in webcam getting hacked as well.
I would say that's a 7 because people forget to, forget to turn it off. My own personal computer laptop has like a slide where I can, and it's always off.
Sure.
Unless I know, for example, that we're doing a video with my little granddaughter just turned 1. So if we're doing a video with my son and his wife and the baby up in Atlanta, then I know I'll slide it over. And so that way they can, you know, she can see us. But normally it's off.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to teach students to put like a sticky note over the webcam.
Yeah, some electric tape.
Right. And nowadays most of them are being built in a way where that slider is there. So I would say about a 7.
A social media connection request where the profile picture is not of a person's face.
10. Oh, yeah. I mean, I got a friend request from a fraternity brother of mine. I thought I was his friend already. And it even had his picture. This was like yesterday, and I'm looking at the, well, wait a second. That doesn't mean it. You know, we've known each other since 1973, and I looked at
I thought we already were friends on this page.
You know, that doesn't make any sense. I didn't click on it because I know that I already was a friend of his.
Mm-hmm.
So.
All right, and my last one, I receive an email that says I get a free trip to the Jamaican Islands.
11? No, I mean, people do, I would never divulge names, but I know a person who actually lost money due to one of those Nigerian prince kind of emails.
Really?
It was an elderly gentleman who didn't know what he was really doing, and then his family had to intervene. But he did lose money. If it's too good to be true, it is. And real quick, the prevention for that, when you get an email like that, you can actually, now it's hard to do on a phone, but on a computer, you take your little mouse pointer over the address. Don't click, just mount what we call mouse over it, and it'll reveal where that came from. And you may have thought it came like from the Jamaica Tourist Bureau or something, and it comes from who knows. It has no email address that makes any kind of sense. And so those go, you know, if my spam filter has not already caught that, it goes immediately into spam.
Let's start with a rather easy question. how close are we at any given moment to losing all digital footprints?
That's pretty broad. All digital footprints, I don't think we're that close. But given, like we saw with the start of the war between Russia and Ukraine, we really thought that they could, that the Russians had the cyber capability to attack the United States, bring down our financial system and a few other things that go with it, bring down industrial systems, what we call SCADA systems, which are what handle our water and electricity and natural gas and things like that. And it turned out that we discovered they're probably not as advanced as we thought they were. And they didn't try to do it anyway, or at least we don't. At my level, I don't know that they tried to do it. Let me tell you, at the annual NSA meeting for universities in Atlanta back in June, one professor got up there and asked our guest speaker, who was the head of research for the NSA, and asked him, how good are our offensive cybersecurity methods? Are they as good as Russia's? And that head of research said, I won't tell you that.
If I tell you, I'd have to kill you.
Right.
And this kind of bleeds into the overall issue that is cybersecurity, where almost in the modern day, cyber warfare is the modern warfare. Is that a fair statement as to the kind of trajectory this field appears to be on?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because if you can bring down somebody's logistics systems, then they can't feed their troops, and they can't give them ammunition, and they can't give them fuel. And as a former Army officer in a combat arm, as an engineer officer, I know that you need to have fuel, food, bullets. You can't do that with, you can't fight a war without that. So if you can interdict their systems and prevent the distribution of those important logistical components, you could stop an enemy from attacking. So cyber warfare is a very crucial component of the United States military's overall force fighting structure.
Would you say that where we are at this point, nationally speaking, are we adequately staffed and skilled to fight off what some of these more cyber warfare tactics look like?
Well, that's an interesting question, because one of the things we tout when we talk about cybersecurity as a career is the number of people that we need in both private and public sector positions. And right now, there's a website, CyberSeek, CyberSeek.org. And CyberSeek.org has the overall estimated number of people we need to fill these positions in the United States. And the number is over 700,000. And it keeps going up. I mean, when I first started teaching, this was maybe 100,000. That was a while ago. That was probably about 15 years ago. But it held steady for a while around the 250,000 level, and only in the past couple of years we've seen this number shoot up to over 700,000 open positions that are needed in cybersecurity. So it's a growing field, and we need a lot of capable people to do the work.
It seems as though this issue is becoming more and more economic. Like, it's not just, when we talk about cybersecurity, we're not just talking about leaving your password open and someone hacking your Facebook account, and we're not just talking about Russia trying to wage war in Europe. We're talking about major economic incentives where things like ransomware, companies are forced to pay millions upon millions of dollars just to ensure the protection of their employees and patients.
The cities have been attacked, small and large. It was a small one in Florida a few years ago. Every government is different. Every business is different as to whether they would be willing to pay up. The recommendation from law enforcement is not to pay up, because the odds are you probably won't get the key back. But if I'm a criminal and I'm thinking, okay, I want to do this multiple times, and I want to be known as a criminal who takes your money and gives you what you asked for so I can keep taking your money or somebody else's money.
Sure.
Then maybe I will give you the key every time. In this way, you know, I get my money, you get your data, where everybody's happy. There are methods to prevent this.
That's almost like modern piracy in a way, isn't it?
It is. It is modern piracy.
Because that's exactly how those old pirate ships would operate, the exact same way. Pirates on those old ships, they didn't want to fight. They didn't want to go into battle. They just wanted to have a reputation of when we show up, give us what you have, and everyone leaves in peace.
Right, and that is very true. That's a very good angle on that. I didn't think of it as modern piracy, but it is in a way. But there are methods, and again, here it's whether a company's willing to pay the cost or not.
Let's step away from the doom and gloom for a second, and let's talk about the heroes in these situations. You teach a few classes that are supposed to essentially train the next class of warriors to help fight these cyber mm-hmm. criminals. I don't want to compare you to a war general, but what's the kind of tone that you try to set in this classroom?
I do emphasize the fact that if you graduate from here with your degree and you go to work in cybersecurity, right off the bat, you're going to be relied on to help that company or that organization protect themselves from threats.
Sure.
And so you're going to be performing a very, very important role in that company, and it's for the protection of that organization. And there's nothing more important. You know, a lot of times information technology is considered to be a cost to a company instead of a profit. You know, people in IT, and like I told you in my bio, I worked in it for 21 years before I became a professor. We never made money for the company. We didn't do cybersecurity in the mid-1980s. but nonetheless, we created systems that were designed to save the company money. To streamline methods of manufacturing or marketing or production. And when cybersecurity came into play, then again, the goal there is to save the company money, in which case it would be saving them their data. So you're never going to make the company money,
mm-hmm.
but it's important. I tell them it's so important that the organization is able to continue and avoid some kind of disaster because of the work that you did in that organization. So I do emphasize that it is very, very important.
Absolutely. I mean, a chain link fence doesn't make a family much money, but it keeps the pets in the yard.
Right.
I mean, with information technology, it seems as though that world constantly changes. The efforts and the defenses are constantly needing to evolve as well. What kinds of programs, what kinds of research do you put into these classes, or do you have your students participate in to kind of get them in that mindset of, I mean, it's a constantly changing world. So what do you do with your students to keep them up to date?
Okay, so first of all, we use labs that are either from the labs are not really on our computers. They're in the cloud. And we use labs from the publisher that we use for two of our textbooks. And they keep those labs up to date. They, as a matter of fact, they just changed to the fourth edition for our 3,000 level course. And those have new software in the lab. So they're using tools online in the cloud that they would use in the real world. And they're using more recent version of those tools. We also have our own server. We paid for this, but it's called NetLab. And those labs are not from the publisher. They're from one of the companies I'm certified from, Palo Alto, which makes firewalls. So the students get experience working with a Palo Alto firewall. And the other is from a company called NDG using Security Plus, which is a certification using their software. And so they update that software also. So the students are using tools for various different things, routers, firewalls, intrusion detection systems, antivirus, password cracking. You know, because in order to be able to defend a password, you've got to be able to break it down, you know, you've got to be able to hack it.
So right.
They have password cracking software on there that they use. And
in order to defeat the enemy, you must learn how to become an enemy.
That's true. And so that's very true. And so the students get the most recent versions. They update that periodically. And so the students get the most recent version of that software as well. As far as our classes, we have several classes that have semester projects where they have to describe how they would defend. They're given a scenario and they have to defend this organization. And so they have to explain how they would change the network and where they would put various different devices, security devices in that network and the rationale for that.
Kind of like a model cyber attack scenario.
Right. Because the whole idea is that the company has experienced attacks. So now how would you prevent this? And that's the whole threat. That's in our network security class. We have our 4,000, 4337 is ethical hacking. So the idea
ethical hacking.
Yeah.
That's an oxymoron if I've ever heard one.
Well, the idea is you're doing it so that you can try and break into an organization with mm-hmm. their permission to determine what they did, you know, what they did wrong. So you can then give them the recommendation on how to correct it. So they learn how to use what we call penetration testing tools in that course to be able to do that. And then our 3,000 level course has a semester long group project. Students hate group projects, but but the thing I emphasize to them is
that I am shocked that those computer students don't like to work in groups.
Yeah.
they seem true. So social.
I know. but the point I try to make to them is that when you get in the real world, you're going to have to work on group projects. And so you've got to be able to cooperate with each other and do the part that's assigned to you. And the group leader has to make sure that everything's done right and then submit it and then it's graded. But the whole, that too is a scenario. They're given, in that class I teach, they're giving two different organizations. Half the class gets one, half the class gets the other. And then they have to come up with a security plan for their organization.
Okay. Now let's go to the micro level. I'd like to talk about what a typical person can do to protect themselves. And I'm going to lead with some statistics here from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Yeah. It's an official branch of the Georgia State Government. And these statistics say 1 in 3 homes with computers are infected with malicious software. 65% of Americans who went online received at least one online scam offer. And at least 47% of American adults have had their personal information exposed by cyber criminals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what comes to your mind when you hear numbers upwards of half of Americans having their information already in peril?
People don't take the time to do simple things to protect their data.
And they really are simple.
They really are.
Okay.
Let's talk about how the data gets into your house first. So typically you have a wireless access point. Sometimes we call it a router. It can do both functions.
Mm-hmm. The thing that you unplug and replug when the internet goes down.
Right. That's true. So that router has what we call a password. Well, it has, let's start with the encryption. It has encryption built into it. But when you install this router, all you have to do is click a checkbox that will install the encryption. They're not going to do it for you, but when you connect it to your computer, it brings up the install screen. There's a checkbox to click that you need to click that will set up the encryption. And then you have to give it a passphrase. Now, we could call it a password, or it could be, if when it's longer, it's a passphrase. And this is what people don't do. They don't change the default password, which could be something stupid like password. but people won't change that. They won't enable the security. They won't change the password from whatever the default is. And the bad guy knows the default password for every device. This is probably about 6, 7, 8 years ago when baby monitors first started getting on Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of cases reported. I think it even made like 60 Minutes or something, or Dateline, one of those shows, where people were controlling the camera in the kid's bedroom.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, because the parent, they knew what the passphrase was for that, whatever the default was, and the parent had never changed it. And the first thing, and then it made a big deal. There was a case, I think, that one was up where you're from. I think that one was up like in Minnesota or somewhere in the Midwest.
Oh, man, that was me? Dang it.
but then there was another one that made Dateline or 2020 or one of those shows where it was a family in Mississippi. And the person started really doing more malicious things than just, you know, making sounds. Because that's what the case up in, it was either Minnesota or Iowa, somewhere up there, it was making weird sounds in the middle of the night. But in Mississippi, the person was actually photographing the child as the child was getting undressed. And again, yes, you could fault the manufacturer, but the parent had not changed the default password. And so anytime you get any device, you need to change the default password. So you start with that router or wireless access point. You enable the security. It should be WPA2. It'll say what kind it is. I can't imagine they make new ones that have what we call WEP, WEP, because that's no longer it's just not secure. But you click on that, you give it some kind of secure passphrase, and it's done. Now, the next thing people don't do is they don't come up with secure passwords for their own, for the websites they visit.
What would you say is the best technique for the ideal password?
The best version is to let them generate one for you that is impossible to remember. I'm serious. We all use passwords that, let's say you're a Georgia Southern alum and, you know, you might use like Eagles in the year that you graduated. And that's really not that good enough unless you made the E lowercase and the A uppercase and the G lower and the L upper and that kind of sequence.
Yeah.
And put some kind of a special character like the hashtag or, you know, the pound sign or asterisk or something like that on the rear end of it or in the middle of it. And that'll work, and it might pass the password meter. That might even say it's strong enough. But you can't use that for everything, so you're going to have to come up with different permutations of it, or you're going to have to come up with different methods of coming up with something new. And so really the best method is to use a password generator that will create gobbledygook that you can't remember, and then make sure you've stored it somewhere with something strong enough that you can remember. Google Chrome has also gotten better about storing the passwords. They've enhanced their security as well. I'm not saying that everybody should go that route and store it in the web browser.
It's so convenient to do it that way.
It is, but I will admit that Chrome has gone to a greater length of using security within the browser to prevent it from being hacked.
You use the phrase passphrase, like you've got a whole sentence in there.
Yeah, so how passphrase works is that take a phrase and you use certain letters from it, you know which letters in that sequence that you took, and that would be a passphrase, as opposed to a password because you used a phrase to generate it.
Well, those are all the prepared questions that I had for you. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about or warn people about on this Cybersecurity Awareness Month?
Just that, again, if it's too good to be true, it is. Too many people fall for those kind of scams. Too many people, another one that's hit the news in the last few months is, especially with COVID and people being shut in, is romance scams.
Oh, sure.
Where people get unsolicited emails or Facebook requests from people that want to become their friend and want to, you know, provide some kind of romantic relationship, and then they fall right into it and they give up all sorts of money and then there's nothing in return. And so that's another issue that falls kind of like the Nigerian scam, but it's a different angle on it. And you just have to be careful and you just have to implement common sense security practices. And again, like I said, if it's too good to be true, it is.
Frank Katz, Assistant Professor with the Department of Information Technology at Georgia Southern University. Sir, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
And thank you all for listening. Be sure to tune in the next 2 weeks for another exciting edition of Eagle Eye View. You can listen to all of our previous episodes on our website at georgiasouthern.edu, or you can find us on Spotify and all your other major podcast platforms. For Eagle Eye View, I'm Jacob Noderman. Catch you next time.